This is Festival Showcase, a weekly interview program that explores the music and the artists behind the 2018 season of the Aspen Music Festival and School and previews upcoming performances. I'm Chris Moore. This program comes to you from Aspen Public Radio, the official voice of the Aspen Music Festival and School, and can be heard online at aspenpublicradio.org. Funding for Festival Showcase is provided by the Barnard Fane Foundation. This week, we look forward to some great vocal performances, and our entire show is devoted to some of the singers and conductors who bring opera and vocal music in general to life here in Aspen. We'll talk with conductor Jane Glover, who guides young conductors wielding the batons at the Opera Scene's Masterclass Saturday at 10, as well as conducting a chamber symphony concert this Friday evening. We'll also chat with the star of Thursday's performance of Trouble in Tahiti. But first, we talk with a young, joyful, opinionated, vibrant opera star who comes to Aspen to sing Mahler's intensely moving song cycle, Das Lied von der Erde. Here's Jamie Barton. Well, Jamie, before we talk about heavy things like Mahler's Das Lied von der Erde, I just want to ask a little bit about the trajectory of your life and how it took you into opera. I know you were born in Rome, Georgia, and opera was not a part of your life as a child the way it is with many people who are trained in music from their earliest days.
My parents were definitely music lovers, but certainly not of the classical sort. They're just, in my area of the United States, there wasn't and still isn't very much of a classical outlet. So I came to it quite late, probably high school. I started getting into musicals, and I was taking piano lessons, and the combination of the two kind of led me to it.
Well, you and I have one thing in common. I read that I can't dance to save my life, and I think you said you couldn't dance to save your soul, so.
That is literally, I can't dance to save my life is a phrase that is very, very accurate and common in my in the way I say it is, I just cannot dance.
And so that being the case, it seems as though, did that actually help draw you to opera? Because there's less, because of course, as a Broadway person, you would have to dance a lot.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I went to a small liberal arts college that had an excellent musical theater program, and my original thought was to go in as a music education major and to kind of not really minor in musical theater, but to get as much from that program as possible. And the very first day of school, I was staring down the reality that I'd have to take ballet at 8 a.m. in a leotard, and I was just like, you know, no, I don't think that's for me. What else would allow me to perform and not have to take dance classes? Oh, opera. I'll go with that. I'll try that one out.
But life's trajectories are often like that. You don't actually plan it out. It just sort of, this is what works, and that's what happened, I guess.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I really consider myself one of the lucky ones. You know, there are so many people who go through the training for classical music and never end up in the career. And I really do feel that my trajectory has been helped along immensely by these little moments that I didn't even understand would guide me in the direction that it has. Like I said, I think I'm one of the lucky ones.
Now, you were talking about at a time in your life that you were not being very disciplined, but I think of you now as a very disciplined singer, not only in terms of how you master your voice, but also language. Your diction and your mastery of so many different languages is something that I think of you as, when I think of you, that's one of the things I think about. Can you tell me at what point you took such a strong interest in the precise diction and the precise way of expressing yourself through the different languages of opera?
The thing about opera that I love, the thing about this art form that really, really put its claws in me and has hooked me ever since, is the storytelling aspect. I really firmly believe that in order to be a good storyteller, I have to be able to tell the story in any language that I'm given. So, you know, if I'm singing it in English, I really need to be able to communicate to the audience in a way that they're not looking down at their programs all the time.
Right.
If I'm singing in German or French or Italian or Russian, what if I go to those countries and sing a concert? I don't want them sitting there going, oh, she's got a very non-German accent, you know?
Sure.
Or if they're listening to my recording, All Who Wander, there are three different languages on that. And two of them were somewhat new for me when I did it, but I really do believe in trying to craft the language in a way that hooks the audience into listening, not so much just for the sound of the voice, but also for the story that's being told. And so that's something that has really, I guess my shorter college days were the beginning of that. You know, the diction courses were certainly new to my life. I grew up in a farm community like you. I didn't exactly have French diction courses at Armorchie High School. But when I got to shorter and this became a part of my regular everyday kind of thing, this was something that I felt was really important to crack. At the same time, this is an aspect of it that I really, really love. I think just as an actress, I really love being able to embody different languages and different accents and being able to do them convincingly. So it's definitely a part of my love of this as well.
As an audience member who does not know Italian and knows a very, very little German, for example, I can still tell when the diction is good. Sometimes I feel like, oh my God, I almost understand what that person is singing when the diction is good. And if the diction isn't good, it's like, I don't think that's really quite the way Italians speak. So I think it's actually even helpful for other people. It brings a certain focus to the audience, I would guess.
Oh, absolutely. I have a theory in that the great composers, even if they composed outside of their language, for the most part, they were really, really good at using the language to get the story across. You know, there's a reason that if you're thinking of Falstaff, you know, tutti cabatti, you know, the big right. fugue at the end. You know, we've got all these double consonants and it kind of skips along the line of the music. I'm a big, big, big believer in using the tools of the language to tell the story. I'm really glad to hear you say that even if you don't know the language, you feel like you're a little more immersed in the story, because as an audience member, I do too. When I hear other singers singing and they're really just comfortable in the language and it feels like something that's natural coming out of their mouth, I'm no longer thinking about the diction. I'm just really enjoying the story that's being told.
I'd like to ask you about the opera world in general and its connection to the larger society, because they're not separate from one another. Even though you might be putting on a lot of 18th and 19th century works, you were still very much in the 20th century, and there are still issues of diversity and casting or any number of things like that, how women are treated as characters and, you know, on stage and off. Can you share any of your thoughts about that aspect of the world of opera and its connection to the larger society we live in?
Oh, absolutely. I feel that opera in many ways has always reflected society in some ways through history from the very beginning to where we are now. And what I'm seeing now is actually a move toward really a lot more diversity in terms of casting and also stories that are relevant to what is being told. And also taking some of the older stories that are on stage and turning them a little, gearing them a little more towards where we are now. Of course, the, the big news out of Bayreuth today is Lohengrin opened up and it has a feminist ending. Ortrude and Elsa end up together. Apparently, they're not worrying about the men. They're not part of the patriarchal society. They're actually, they have their own autonomy and they're going on, and Lohengrin goes away ashamed, which is definitely, you know, first of all, to have the first American director ever at Bayreuth do something like this is a major, major, major move, but I can't help but think that his decision to do this is really a reflection of the time that we're in. Personally, I'm really, really interested in seeing these endings. You know, these classical stories with the different endings, the Carmen that happened recently where in the end she kills Don Jose instead of Don Jose killing her. You know, a lot of people are certainly up in arms about this, and that's to be expected. But I'm really, really interested in seeing how stories can be told from different points of view. I do believe, and I think it's reflected in so many ways, maybe the least of which is the fact that the vast majority of opera composers that we know of and that we do on a regular basis are men. I think it's really interesting to start having the points of view of other people, of women, of people of color, of queer people. You know, it's, and I'm loving seeing, especially I think on the smaller scales, seeing this happening. You know, I love what I'm hearing from Beth Morrison projects, from R.B. Schlather, these directors that are really kind of stepping out and making something that really hits people square in the gut. I think it's a really exciting time, and we're in for some changes, but I'm here for those changes. Absolutely.
I'll never forget, gosh, it was maybe 10 years ago or so at Santa Fe, they had a Così fan tutte where the two female leads look at each other like, these men are such jerks, and then they hold hands and they walk off together. So I think that's exactly what you're talking about in general. But I have to ask you a little bit about Das Lied von der Erde. This is a very weighty work about death from a man who realized that his own death was not far away. Can you say just a few words about that?
Well, I just when I was practicing through this earlier this week, I sent out a tweet along the lines of, I'm just so grateful to be doing this piece at this particular point in my life. Obviously, the op sheet is something that everybody knows, but the final piece, it's just stunningly and breathtakingly and achingly beautiful. As a mezzo, I'm very, very used to singing the topics of longing and farewell and all of these weightier issues. But what I love about the three songs that I get to do in this is that Mahler really kind of showed a gamut of flavors. The first song is really, it's about solitude and needing rest, but wanting that rest, the kind of heart rest, to be with someone, to have that with another person. My second song is, all about flirtation and young people, and this girl who seems to have an icy demeanor actually is melting inside because she loves this boy. And then the op sheet, it's its own, gosh, it's nearly an opera. It's, it's saying farewell to a friend. In my reading of it, I believe the friend has died already, and the person singing is trying to cope with that. And I think if anybody has ever experienced loss, or quite honestly, if anybody has a heart, they'll get this.
Yes.
It hits you on the ground level of life. And I just absolutely adore it. I'm so excited to be bringing this to Aspen.
Well, Jamie, thank you again so much for your time and sharing so much in such a short time. And we will look forward to hearing your rendition of the Mahler.
Well, thank you very much. It's a delight to talk with you.
Mezzo-soprano Jamie Barton, who sings Das Lied von der Erde of Mahler with the Aspen Festival Orchestra this Sunday at 4. I also caught up with conductor and author Jane Glover, who has a busy schedule this week conducting Tchaikovsky and Haydn this Friday with the Chamber Symphony and guiding the young conductors from the pit at the Opera Scene's Masterclass at the Wheeler this Saturday at 10. Well, Jane, thank you for making your way over to Aspen Public Radio. I think this is the first time we've ever chatted before.
It's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about what you're planning on conducting here in Aspen just in the next couple of weeks.
Well, I'm here at the moment with the ACCA conducting students, looking after them as they prepare the Mozart opera scenes in the Wheeler. That's fascinating because, this ACCA conducting program is absolutely wonderful. And I think for many of them, this is the first time they've actually been in an opera pit, in a theater pit. So that's a whole different skill that they're having to adapt to. And so I'm working with them this week. And then next week, I'm with the Chamber Symphony, doing a lovely program on Friday night with the great Alyssa Weilerstein, who plays the Tchaikovsky Rococo Variations. And so we've put together a program which is sort of based on variations and rewrites and looking back to the 18th century and so on.
As Tchaikovsky himself did in the Rococo Variations.
Of course, yes.
He just loved those older composers. I think
he did.
He worshipped Mozart, I know.
He did. Oh, gosh, yes. And that's why we're doing the fourth suite, which is the Mozartiana suite, which is wonderful. You know, I haven't done it for ages, actually. I'm happy to come back to it. It's another fabulous set of variations at the end, with quite challenging individual instrumental parts, but, you know, also a wonderful sort of his version of the Ave Verum Corpus and that sort of thing, real favourite stuff of Mozart. And it's lovely to sort of see Mozart through his eyes. For instance, the Mozart orchestrations of Handel, for instance, you know, it's a little bit like his version of Messiah. The structure, the house, is the architecture is Mozart, but the decoration, the interior decoration is by Handel. And it's the same with this Tchaikovsky stroke Mozart feel. And I love it for that. And so you partly approach it as a Mozartian, but you very much interpret it as a Tchaikovskian, because you know,
yes,
parts of it sound like the Nutcracker. And apropos, we're also adding that little Stravinsky reorchestration of what he called it, Bluebeard, of the the pas de deux from the Nutcracker, which is another lovely little bit of seeing somebody through somebody else's eyes.
When I think of Jane Glover, I think of, okay, Monteverdi, Handel, the great Baroque composers, and also, of course, Mozart. Here you are in a Tchaikovsky realm. How often do you go to late romantics like Tchaikovsky as a conductor?
Well, you're right that my sort of musical heart is in the 18th century. And certainly, you know, you had to put me on the spot and say, one composer only, who would it be? It would, of course, be Mozart for me. But I'm very happy to be playing a Haydn symphony in this concert, by the way, which is great. But to answer your question, I mean, my repertoire is much broader, I think, than a lot of people realize. I do a lot of contemporary music, for instance, and I certainly go back to the 16th century with Monteverdi. I mean, there are certain parts of the 19th century that I have never touched and sadly probably never will. But Tchaikovsky feels just wonderful. I love playing Tchaikovsky.
And I would think especially this kind of Tchaikovsky, which does harken back to the era you're
with. But, you know, of operatic experiences, of which I have many, you know, I've been doing Onegin, for instance, is just one of the great, great delights and challenges, indeed. Challenges mainly linguistically for me, because it's the only time I've done an opera where I don't speak the language. And so, one's preparation, or even read it, actually, one's preparation for conducting Onegin was 20 times longer than anything else, because one had to master the text first. But then, having done that, it's just such a rich experience. And so I love to do Tchaikovsky.
Tell me if there's any major contemporary operas that you've conducted or even premiered recently, because I'd be interested in hearing about that and what kind of contemporary language that they are using.
One of the most thrilling experiences, actually, was when I was director of opera at the Royal Academy of Music, and we, together with Juilliard, commissioned an opera from Peter Maxwell Davis called Komilitonen, Young Comrades. Absolutely brilliant opera with three stories told sort of simultaneously about student reaction, actually. It was written for and about young people in three different stories intertwined. Absolutely brilliant. And I got to do the premiere of that in London, directed by David Pountney, who wrote the libretto. And David and Max were at all rehearsals all the time, and it was so thrilling. It was like having Mozart and Da Ponte in the room, you know, and they would sort of say to each other, "Oh well, we need a bit more here, or we should just cut that down there." And just being part of the sort of latter part of the creative process was thrilling for me, but also for the students. Can you imagine? Some of whom were extremely good at contemporary music, could read it and learn it quite easily, but others were quite challenged by it, and we prepared them. And I think David apparently was very impressed that by the first staging rehearsal they were all off book and ready. And that's one of the most thrilling things I've ever done. I mean, I mentioned another composer because we've sadly just lost him, and that's Oliver Nussen. And I was very much part of Ollie's circle in the 80s when he wrote Where the Wild Things Are, you know, the great Sendak book and libretto and illustrations and designs. Ollie and I shared that, and he was famously bad at deadlines, bless his heart. And he was still writing it, actually, on the morning of the premiere.
That sounds like Mozart, actually.
Well, I think Mozart never sailed quite as close to the wind as Ollie did, to be honest. Having said that, of course, he never finished his recitatives for La Clemenza di Tito, which, as it happens, I did hear last year. But for different reasons, I think. Mozart rarely missed a deadline. Sadly, Ollie often did. But what a great man, and such a loss to contemporary music.
Yes. Have you ever tried your hand at composing, just out of curiosity?
Not since I was 17.
I see.
Like all romantic teenagers, you know, I thought this is what I do. And then I went up to university, when I went up to Oxford, and I met some real composers, and I thought, maybe not. No.
Right.
I have made performing editions of the early operas that I've done by Monteverdi, and particularly Cavalli. I've done all three Monteverdi operas in my own editions, and indeed did one of them here a few years ago, and many by Cavalli. A certain amount of reconstruction comes to the fore of that, And so being able to write string parts and so on is very necessary. But that's as far as I go these days.
I see. Okay.
I'm still basically an interpreter rather than a creator.
You're very well established as a conductor, especially in Britain, but also really around the world. But I wonder if you would be interested in sharing some of the challenges that you had to face as a woman, as a young woman, when you were first trying to establish yourself as a conductor. Because in your early days, there weren't very many models that you had.
That's true. And I rejoice in the fact that there are now many, many more than when I started.
Mm-hmm.
There are still not nearly enough of us, but we're getting there. You know,
right.
We're getting
yes.
there. And I would say one thing, though, that it's always been terribly important to me that none of us is appointed as a token.
Exactly.
And I hope we're only given engagements because people like what we do. If we've ever missed engagements or indeed been handed engagements because we are a woman, then both of those are wrong. The only thing that matters is the quality of the work. And, mm-hmm. you know, if people like you, they ask you back. Yes, it was tough at the beginning. And even now, you know, there are... I mean, in 2013, I made my debut at the Met and I was only the third woman to conduct there. I mean, this is sort of ridiculous. There have now been four because Susanna Malky's been since me.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it is crazy. It is crazy because there are some great women out there. And, I mean, one meets them here and all over the place. And, of course, the great Marin Alsop, who is just a beacon for us all, a good friend. And it's just great what she's doing and the way she's sort of conquering the planet is absolutely great. You know, there's still a certain resistance, but I think we're getting there. We're just quietly marching on. But as I say, the bottom line is it any good?
Yes. Is your work any good?
Yeah.
And if they can answer that in the positive and they hire you, then great.
Yeah.
And that's really finally all that matters.
Absolutely.
Yes. You were talking about some of your friends. Nick McGeegan is somebody who's really popular around here. I know some people come just to hear his concert. They drive in from Denver just for that and nothing else. It would seem to me as though the two of you must have crossed paths.
Nick and I go back so many decades that we probably don't want to admit it, but we were graduate students together at Oxford, and we've known each other since then, and we played for each other, and I played continuo for him, and he played continuo for me, and he played flute for me, and he lent me his motorbike, this is important, at Oxford. He had a car and a moped, and he didn't need both, so he's such a generous, gorgeous guy, he lent me his moped for a whole year,
oh, goodness.
And a yellow crash helmet, which he told me the other day he'd only just thrown away. So, you know, we were that close. And then, of course, we drifted apart. He made his life over here in California, but our lives intersect often, not enough, but often here, actually. I'm sorry,
yes.
I missed him this year. And it's just lovely. We go to each other's concerts. I remember one time in Australia, we overlapped in doing different things. And it's just so much fun. And as you say, he's got the gift of eternal youth, and he's one of the most ebullient and charismatic performers. And what you see is what it is. I mean, that's who Nick is. He's just a gorgeous, fantastic musician, and my goodness, what he's achieved is just great. So we rejoice in all that.
I also rejoice that you're actually able to spend a fair amount of time in Aspen as a teacher and as a conductor. Because I look at your schedule and I think, oh my gosh, you're one of those people that has like almost no home address. You're just on planes all the time. Isn't it nice to be able to just kind of settle down in Aspen and be with friends and colleagues here?
Absolutely. And I mean, Aspen has become for me just one of the most important things in the diary. And I hope they keep asking me because
yes.
I just love it here. It sort of ticks all the boxes, you know, high class music making, a huge amount of repertoire. I mean, I love discovering things, going to all these chamber music concerts and hearing pieces of music I've never heard before. And always the standards are so high. And by the way, the Rockies. You know?
Oh,
so
yeah,
the hiking is pretty damned amazing, too.
Uh-huh.
And no, I just absolutely adore it here.
Can you remember how many years you have been a part of the Aspen Music Festival? And
well, I was trying to top that up. I missed a couple, I think, but I think I've been coming about 10 years now.
Mm.
And I seem to alternate opera one year and concerts the next year. So
right.
Cross fingers, I might be doing an opera next year, but we'll see what they come
okay.
up with.
Okay. We'll keep that a secret for now.
Okay.
Jane, I thank you so much for your time here, and we are really looking forward to hearing what you do with Tchaikovsky.
Thank you very much. Well, I'll have the great Alyssa Weilerstein with me, so that'll
be a lot of support.
And we've worked together before here. I can't wait. She's just
yes,
great.
She's a great, great musician.
Fantastic.
Conductor and author Jane Glover conducts Tchaikovsky and Haydn this Friday with the Chamber Symphony and guides the young conductors from the pit at the Opera Scene's Masterclass at the Wheeler this Saturday at 10. Finally, let's hear from Zarai Rodriguez as she prepares to take on the lead role in Bernstein's Trouble in Tahiti, What a Movie Scene, this Thursday at 8 at Harris Concert Hall.
I think definitely, as a general note, you do have to be classically trained to sing this role just because it goes in a wider range than more musical theater repertoire would be as far as a tessitura. Mm-hmm. However, he does really use the rhythms and the dance styles of musical theater and of the 1950s dance styles. So you really have to be aware of that and kind of find a happy medium between both.
So we know that you're being well-trained in the world of opera and you're making that transition from student to professional. You're going to be at the Florida Grand Opera at the Studio Young Artist Program after this, and I'm sure that's going to be very exciting.
I'm very excited.
Get to enjoy some nice warm weather.
Yes, and Miami is actually my hometown where I grew up.
Oh.
So it'll be nice to go back home for a few months and work there.
So you've got, obviously, you're really getting a lot of training on the operatic side, but tell me, have you done anything in the way of cabaret or musical theater or something that prepares you for the other side of Leonard Bernstein?
Well, actually, I grew up singing more contemporary pop music. Mm-hmm. Just as a general note, you kind of have to be a chameleon in a way to be able to do different types of genres and styles.
When I think of the rhythmic aspect of the music in Trouble in Tahiti, I don't actually think of Tahitian rhythms so much as I actually think of more like Hispanic or Cuban American or whatever. I mean, it seems as though Leonard Bernstein just sort of picked up some of the popular dance rhythms and that sort of thing that are part of here, you know, United States larger culture. Do
right.
you think that's true? Or?
Once you hear Tahiti, and if you're familiar with Wet Side Story, you'll see
right.
the very, very similar rhythms and that make Bernstein Bernstein.
Mm-hmm.
The opera itself is, in a way, kind of a stereotype of people and what people may think. It's not necessarily a truth of reality.
Sure, of course.
So the fact that he used rhythms that possibly most people would be okay with but still think is exotic just allows
right.
more for the audience to understand how Dinah and Sam felt in the 1950s.
Now, your character, Dinah, is an interesting one, especially for you being as young as you are. People who are older would look at that and they could recognize themselves immediately or their parents immediately because
yes.
that 50s lifestyle and that repression and all that. The particular kind of angst and misery that Bernstein puts into this work, how do you relate to it? Because I guess millennial angst is quite different from this.
Right. You know, that's a very interesting question. I would say I came through the point of view of there's a universal truth in this. Mm-hmm. We all go through relationships, and every relationship, even a healthy one, will go through fights and will go through lulls. And so I think at the core of it, it's just the human relationship of people changing and still wanting to be together, but having that constant fight. I grew up with really great parents. However, being from first generation Cuban American, it is in a way very similar to the 50s, 60s era. And maybe it's the same with other people, I don't know. But it's important to kind of have a good appearance, for example, or don't let people know what happens behind the closed doors, for example.
Right.
I, you know, had a great family life, but as far as the Cuban culture, it is not very dissimilar from that era in
50s
a way.
America.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
So
well, that's good to know. So you did find a point of connection. You didn't have to go back as if you're going back to 17th century France or something.
Right.
Try to understand that. Well, Zarai, thank you so much for taking the time to come here. We look forward to seeing you in Trouble in Tahiti.
Thank you.
I hope you stir up a lot of trouble on the stage.
Thank you so much.
Zarai Rodriguez, who has the lead role in Bernstein's Trouble in Tahiti, What a Movie Scene, this Thursday at 8. This has been Festival Showcase, a weekly interview program that explores the music and the artists behind the 2018 season of the Aspen Music Festival and School and previews upcoming performances. This program comes to you from Aspen Public Radio, the official voice of the Aspen Music Festival and School, and can be heard online at aspenpublicradio.org. Please join me Tuesdays at 3:30. My name is Chris Moore. Thanks for listening.